Hey, this is Dylan Nadler, and you're watching The Marcus Deegan Show.
The Marcus Deegan Show! What's the story, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Deegan, shooting from one of the greatest places on earth, my friends. If you've never been here, you've got to come here. Sin City, Las Vegas, Nevada. The place of bright lights and world title fights. I'm your host. We are right next to the UFC Apex in the beautiful Sticky Paw Studios, ready to shoot another pod. If you're listening on Spotify, I do appreciate it. And those that are following us on YouTube, thank you so much. The subscribers are going up every single week and we're getting some really good views. I've been trying to pump the YouTube channel. We're doing great on social media. We're doing great on Spotify. But if you want to do us a favor, follow us on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe, all that business. I put a lot of effort in and put out some great content every single week. I don't ask for anything. I don't ask for money. All I ask for is support. So if you like what you see, give me a like, give me a share, and leave a comment. It's as easy as that. Today, we got another sensational podcast. Guys, when I interview all these fighters from the UFC, and it's up over 120 of them now, one thing that fascinates me more than anything is the mind. All of them say that sports, especially fighting, is 90% mind and maybe 10% the body. And that has always fascinated me. I believe that we don't even know how much of our brain power that we can use because we only use a small bit of it. The guy that I've got coming on right now in the studio today, well, I mean, he's got a lot of names that you could call him. What would it be? A mental coach, a life coach, an expert on manifestation, just someone that knows their shit and is Mr. Positive all the time. And I love that. And I'm very blessed to have a mental performance coach that's done athletes from Bellator, athletes from the UFC, and now he's in here today. We're going to have a little bit of a chat. Give us up for my main man, Dylan Nadler. What's up, brother?
What's going on? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Where'd you come from today?
Toronto.
Okay, so you came all the way. Okay, right. I didn't know that. I mean, you said that you're in Canada, but I didn't realize that you came from Toronto today. How's the weather in Toronto?
You know what? It's not the worst right now, but definitely way better over here. And I guarantee when I land on Saturday, go back home, there's for sure going to be a lot of snow.
Yeah, because you got to acclimatize when you go back. I mean, I suppose coming over for a few days, but it doesn't really make a difference. So you'd be loving the weather here in Las Vegas right now, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if this is a cooler day for you guys, like, this is like our springtime type of thing.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. What was it? I think it was about 65 or 67 today here in sunny Las Vegas. It was unbelievable. Okay, my first question. First of all, I want to tell you, I've been really excited about this podcast because I've been stalking your Instagram and I don't think there's one thing that you have said that I don't agree with or I haven't absorbed or I'm going to put into practice. I want to find out how you developed your mind to help others develop theirs. Considering that you suffered with anxiety and stress, and I heard another podcaster say that you are the expert at turning fault into leverage. So I want to hear about that. What's the difference between manifestation and positive mindset?
That's a good question. I think it comes down to action, right? You know, positive mindset is one thing to just kind of say positive things. I think in this day and age, we're getting a little bit close sometimes to like toxic positivity in the sense where let's just close our eyes and say everything's great, right? And it's why a lot of people don't love it too much either, because it's like, you know, let's be real, like everything's not always going to be great, you know. I'm a realist instead. So it's like there has to be something in the middle, and I think it comes down to not just saying the right things but having a purpose for it. So for example, you know, what's the difference between like a toxic positivity thing? If you're sparring and you break your foot kicking someone's elbow, you're not going to go back and say that was a great day, you know, I love today. No, that, you know, it's positive but not in the right way, right? But there can be an optimistic spin, which, you know what, now that I'm injured and maybe I have to take a few weeks off of practice, instead of just sitting down and being depressed the entire time and having nothing to do, I'm going to focus on some of the areas of my game I haven't focused on as much, maybe watching film, maybe recovery, maybe stretching, right? So you can be optimistic without it being like toxically, just, you know, it rubs people the wrong way.
Right.
And I think that's one of the biggest distinctions is you can always have a positive mindset and be optimistic about things, but it has to be grounded in some sort of truth. The moment it's not is when you rub people the wrong way and it becomes kind of this corny thing.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. So do you think, I've really been successful with manifestation. And once again, I think a lot of people think that it's just about thinking it, but you've said that there's action involved. You have to put steps into place to achieve these things. Now, I had to write a couple of things down because I do maybe four of them and I'm going to try and do the other ones. You have said that here are some of the essential steps to getting mental skills or preparing your brain for changing it from how you are. Cognitive therapy kind of thing. So there's six things, guys, and I don't know if you do this, but I'm going to start. You have to have goals.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. The second one is to journal your thoughts and your ideas. Can you explain why that is important?
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things to talk about, actually. So there's three.
How did I know that?
There you go. It's because you were stalking my Instagram.
Right, that's true. I was.
There's three main benefits to journaling after a practice. And first of all, what's it even mean? Take out a notepad, leave it in your sparring bag, and after every training, write down a little bit. It doesn't have to be a lot. You know, it could be something, and over time it'll get better, like any habit. But it's essentially just talking about what did I do in this practice? How did I feel about it? What were things that frustrated me? What were things that felt good? What was I striving for? And then you kind of end it off with how you can make the next one better or build off of it, right? So that's kind of first of all, because a lot of people ask, well, what do I even write? So that's kind of a simple framework is what did you do? How did you feel about it? And how can we build off of that next time? Three main benefits to journaling after every training session. Number one, simply, you're just documenting your progress, right? We overestimate our memory a lot of the time, and people say, well, you know, I remember my good trainings, obviously. And it's like, okay, well, what if I said, tell me about practice on August 4th? You'd be like, I have no idea, right? So really it establishes almost like a time capsule that you can go back and just have a log of every single practice, and that alone is extremely valuable, right? Number two is it allows you to build and develop your sense of self-awareness. So self-awareness, like cardio and strength, it's a skill you develop, right? Something as simple as, let's say you and I are sparring and you keep catching me with this jab. You keep catching me with this jab. And I find myself getting frustrated, getting worked up. I rush in because I'm frustrated and I get caught with something even bigger.
Aldo, right? McGregor.
There you go. I would be able to then write in my journal, okay, I was sparring with Marcus. He kept catching me with this jab. I got frustrated. I rushed in. Next time, or maybe not next time, maybe a week later, a month later, and I keep putting this down, I'm starting to build this awareness that this happened. So now the next time I feel myself getting frustrated and getting worked up, instead of rushing in and making the same mistake I've made 100 times, I have the clarity to say, okay, you know what? I'm feeling kind of frustrated. I'm going to take a step back and disengage, shake it off, angle out, and get back into it. So what you just did is you used this journaling process to make yourself more aware of these things that are happening, these little nuances of competing, and it actually helps you in the moment so you don't make the same mistakes you're making a bunch of times. And then the third part, my favorite part of the whole journaling process, is it allows you to look at trends and all of that information. So one of my favorite quotes, it says, you have to collect the dots to connect the dots, right? Mm. And every time you journal, you're just gathering information. And the first day, you might not, you know, see anything that stands out. The second day, you might not either. After a week, after a month, you can take a step back and you might say, oh my God, I didn't realize that, you know, this led to this and this led to that. So you get to really paint a picture with what you see, but you wouldn't see anything if you didn't document it, right? So you might say, oh, you know, I've been training for a month now. What were my three best practices? And you go back and you look at it and you say, oh, okay, interesting. On my three best practices, this is what I ate for breakfast that day. Or this is what my work schedule was like that day. Or this is who I partnered with. You might say, well, how about my three worst training sessions? Again, how did I sleep? What did I eat? What kind of drills did we do? Who did I partner up with? What did my day look like leading up to that? So the ability to just look at all this information, collect the dots, connect them, and then say, oh my God, like there's so many insights that can be gained. And it's not that this won't happen if you don't journal. You're just expediting that process,
right?
You're giving yourself free experience. It might take a fighter or any athlete years until they realize these things about themselves. Mm. If you journal it and you have it in a very like succinct, organized place, you can chop that time down to like small percentages, and you can figure out things that it takes people years to identify in weeks and months.
I love that. This is one I have a little bit of a problem with.
Okay.
This is sometimes I do the opposite. Positive self-talk. I suppose your body doesn't know if it's you saying it or somebody else saying that you're a piece of shit or you're a fool. You're just hearing those words, whether it's being said from someone else or it's in your own head. Why is positive self-talk so important?
It's a great question. It's the internal dialogue that we all have. And unfortunately, for the most part, it's always negative. It's always critical. And that's just kind of how we're developed in that process of being criticized and second guessing things. And a lot of people might be listening to this and go, well, I don't think I have like too much of a negative voice in my head. The thing is, everybody does. It's just the awareness of it is so low, right? So I'll give you an example. Alarm goes off in the morning, right? Your first thought is, fuck, I'm exhausted, right? Right away. That's like one piece of negative self-talk right there that carries into the rest of the day. And that's just one. There's hundreds of things that happen. So the ability to reassure yourself and encourage yourself, even amongst challenging times, is very, very important, especially in a sport like fighting where you're the only one in the cage, right? Like,
yeah.
it's a team sport in how you train and how you prepare, but it's very individual the moment that cage shuts. And of course, you have your coaching and you have your feedback, but at the end of the day, it's just you.
Yeah.
And if that voice is discouraging and that voice is critical, your ability to do the right things and continue to perform at a high level as the fight goes on and you face more and more obstacles, it's tough, right? So if you have that ability to reinforce that positive self-talk, you know, you keep telling yourself, hey, I've got this, let's keep doing this. You have different kind of personalized triggers that work better for you. Everybody's a little bit different, but you want that kind of voice in the back of your head to be as positive, as optimistic, again, you know, in a realistic way as possible, because when the doors are closed and you're the only one in there, you need to be able to, you know, bite down and find that will to continue. And it's not going to come from being overtly critical and just hard on yourself.
Nothing comes from that, right? Positive mind, positive life. Love that. How many good clips are we going to get out of this, Lana?
So many.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be fantastic. Okay, here's another one that I so believe in, and I learned this when I went to treatment, where they teach you when you go to rehab for drugs, is that the one thing they say is people, places, and things. What you have here is part of the essential mental skills. Step number 5 is surround yourself around inspiring people. A lot of these power slap guys that I'm talking to a lot in the last couple of weeks have told me that being around people like Hunter and Dana White has changed them. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what's the popular thing that goes around? It says you become like your group of 5 people or something like that is kind of who you become closest to in terms of how your own personality is molded, right? So it's no different than when you're a kid and you're in school and, you know, the teachers and parents are saying, oh, they're really smart, but they don't apply themselves, right? And the group of friends is causing trouble. Like that was me. Like I was that kid in elementary school and stuff like that. And, you know, nothing wrong with the people I was around with, but you know, what you want, you have to be very intentional about. And if you want success, you need to surround yourself with people that, it doesn't mean already successful people, because, you know, we don't want to be divas and say, oh, I only, you know, surround myself with successful people, but people that you can respect, people that you can appreciate, people that have a vision, people that won't look at your vision and think it's stupid or think that it's strange and say, oh, well,
that's the one right there. Yeah. You just gave me goosebumps then. That's the one right there, is that you don't want people to look at you and think that you're stupid. Oh, that's great. I love that.
Yeah. When you say, oh, I'm going to be a UFC champion, and people go, yeah, you know, cool. Like, You don't want that. Again, people are going to have those reactions, but you want to be with people that are like, go for it. Like, why can't you? You know, if you say it and you believe it, and most importantly, you do the right things to back it up, because there is a difference between just kind of saying things and not doing the right things behind it. But if you say the right things and you commit yourself to the process, why can't you get everything that you want? And you want to surround yourself with people that are inspiring and people that, you know, have their own visions for themselves. And most of all, people that you enjoy spending time with and don't feel like you need to make yourself kind of smaller around.
And the lucky last, which is another one that I have always, always said and always gone with, is that you have to prioritize quality over quantity. Can you explain that?
Yep. Yeah. I love this one too, because as athletes, one of the biggest issues that come up over and over again is overtraining and burnout, right? I think any high-level athlete has felt this feeling before of kind of burning the candle at both ends. And the reality is that you will never win the quantity game. You just can't. You know, if you're waking up at 6, someone's waking up at 5. If you're training 4, you know, 3 sessions a day, someone's training 4. Like, you can't bank on winning the quantity game. You just can't. It's a lose-lose type of cycle. But you can win on quality, which is that, you know what? I'm going to train as many days a week as I feel healthy doing, where I can give, you know, my best every single time I'm there. Again, pushing myself very, very hard. But, you know, adding more isn't always the answer. You know, if you show up and you're giving 60% at every training session because you're there every single day, 3 times a day, is that any better than going half of that time, but being able to give 85, 90, 95% every time you're there and crushing it? You're developing at a much better progress rate, and it's just better for your mental health overall. You're not going to burn out as quick. So that's what I like to say to any athlete that really feels like they're just burning the candle at both ends. It's that you'll never win on quantity, but you can win on quality if you show up and you're goal-oriented and you're focused and you're driven and you know exactly why you're there. You're intentional with your time. Like, focus on quality, because we can all do that. The quantity thing is just kind of a game that you can't win.
Can you do both?
You can max out, I think, the limits of your own comfort. And what I mean by that is, you know, some people can, for example, Muay Thai fighters, they do a lot of running, right? It's part of the culture, right? Run, you know, miles before practice, right? You know, I'm not the type of person where like that would have helped me at all. Like,
right.
I think it just, you know, would have made my legs more sore and I wouldn't have been as explosive. Again, I was a Taekwondo fighter, so maybe that springiness is more important. But, you know, individually, like that method of just running before practice, I don't think it would have helped me necessarily, versus some people who are built a little bit different or enjoy different types of workouts and cardio and stuff like that, could be great for them. So when it comes to quantity and quality, there's no like equation to it, which is, you know, this plus this equals this. It's figure out yourself, which is how often can you train at a very high level before you find that quality start to deteriorate a little bit, right? That's, I think, a lot more of an important question than looking at the perfect rate for things.
So how long have I been here in this studio now, Lana? Do you know how long? Is it 8 weeks?
Oh.
10 weeks?
Yeah, I think so. Cause I thought you meant like 16 minutes. So I was like, yeah, you're 16 minutes in.
No. I meant like in the building.
I think about like 3 months now.
Yeah. So
possibly.
In 3 months, I've done 27 podcasts, which is a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. It is like,
that's a lot.
It is a lot. So am I on the path to burning myself out? Because obviously we have the quality. I've been doing so much content. That's the quantity. Where am I going to go wrong here, and what do I need to do? Back off on the doing so many?
Your passion leads it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, again, you go until you find the quality deteriorate. So if you're doing, again, you could do a podcast a day, and you might be the type of person where you're energized enough to do that, you know, you're focused while you're there. You might notice that, you know, in a month from now, you're finding yourself getting a little bit more distracted, you know, making a little bit more errors, finding that kind of drive to show up to the studio, you know, dwindling a little bit. And at the end of the day, is the high quantity worth the lack of quality? Let's say it gets to that point. I don't think so, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very good show. You have a great setup here. Like, you know, it's clear that like this means something to you.
Yeah.
So is it worth it for 5 more recordings a month to lower the quality by those by enough where the audience picks up on it and like, I don't know if I want to watch this guy anymore because he seems, you know, like he's not into it, right? People want to watch someone where they can feel that passion and they see, man, this guy's really committed. He's asking great questions. He's investing into the guests. He's not just, you know, asking them surface level questions because he didn't do any research about them. Like, it's the quality that keeps people. You could have 100 episodes, but if someone watches one and they watch the wrong one and they don't love it, they're not going to watch anymore. You get a 5 episodes, but if they're amazing, you're going to get them every single time. So the way to balance that too is it all comes down to the recovery side. And I think, you know, anyone that's worried about burning out or overtraining, you have to think of it as this kind of balancing act between the exertion side and the recovery side. So the question too is, well, what are you doing to recover, right? What do you do to relax? What do you do to kind of re-energize yourself and re-engage and refocus and take yourself away from things? So a lot of athletes exert themselves at a very high rate, but the recovery side is nowhere near where it should be,
right?
So maybe it's sauna, maybe it's massage, maybe it's whatever. But if you want to be able to exert more, you have to recover more. So, you know, if you find yourself in the future feeling a little bit burnt out, the question just becomes, number one, is it a quality quantity thing? And number two, what can we do on the other side of the equation, which is the, you know, recovery part, to maybe boost that to then refuel, you know, the passion you have for this?
Guys, if you think this is a therapy session for me, you're absolutely right.
That was just going to, I wanted to add, because when you necessarily, I can't see you being burnt out just because your show, he has genuine passion for his show. None of your shows are boring. None of your shows are like you don't look like you don't want to be here. And none of them. You always bring 110% to all of your shows. So no matter 27 shows in a few months, bro, you're killing the fucking game.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot, Lana. And that's going to segue into my next guys, I don't, you see me when I do my podcast, right? I don't write stuff down, but I had to write things down for Dylan today because there were so many things that resonated with me when I was stalking his Instagram and listening to his podcast and listening to his words and writing down things. So I didn't want to, listen, I could have done 50 pages. Now here's one thing that I really, really love. And this is so true. And maybe this goes with why I'm trying to pump out so many episodes. Is that fear? Yeah. All right. Hang on a second. I'm just trying not to get emotional here.
We love fear.
Fear of failure is fear of judgment. Fear of judgment.
That's a good one.
And that is so true. When I, hang on a minute, I'm going to get emotional again.
Do it.
When I read that, you know how sometimes you read a quote or you read a sentence or you read a couple of words and it does something to you? It opens something in your mind that you go, fuck, that's so many things that you have said have done that. And that was why I wrote that down. Fear of failure is just a fear of shame. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's an important one. Clearly, a lot of people who I work with, you know, they'll talk about that, you know, fear of failure. And I like to challenge that because, again, if no one was watching, would you be scared, right? And most of the time the answer is like, well, no. You know, if you're just sparring and there's nobody watching, is it that big of a deal if you lose a round in training? Like, well, no. Okay, so then when you put the lights and the cameras and the crowd and your family's there and your friends are there, now, you know, that same failure is a lot scarier, but it's not that the environment is much different. It's the judgment around it, right? I saw someone reference this point of, you know, when you're playing a video game and you die at a certain level, you're not embarrassed by that. You just keep doing it, right? So it's not the failure itself that we're scared of, because in closed off situations where there's no viewers, it doesn't matter. We're able to pick ourselves up a lot easier and more efficiently and keep pushing along. It's that fear of judgment of, well, what are people going to say? I'm going to have to post about this. You know, I've been hyping this fight up for a long time. You know, I'm on a roll and I'm undefeated. All these different reasons that, you know, we disguise as I'm afraid of failing. But when you understand that you only fail when you stop playing, it changes the way that you think about it. So it's like, it's not a failure at all. A lot of these reasons why people come up with, well, I'm scared of this, I'm scared of that. And ultimately, you know, like we're talking about this fear of failure, it's fear of being judged. It's fear of, you know, that judgment from outside people. And the first question is, well, who are you scared of judging you? Again, is it family? Is it friends? Is it teammates? And a lot of the time it circles back to, well, the closest people to you, you shouldn't worry about, right? It's all the outside people, like the 3 to 5 to 7, like close people in your inner circle. They don't care. They just want to see you have the best time you can have and follow that passion. And when you're feeling great, they're feeling great. When you're upset, they're upset. Like the closest people in your innermost circle just want to support you however they can. If anyone's judging you, it's going to be people on the outside, people on the exterior that really don't care either way.
MMA fans.
And they're going to forget about it, right? Yeah. That's the funny thing about all these like outside people is they'll forget. You know, let's say you have a random fan watching a fight and, you know, you get knocked out and you feel like it's the most embarrassing thing and, oh, everyone's going to talk about it. You know, 45 seconds later when the next person's walking in, they're already thinking about that next person. And then as soon as that, you know, card is over and, you know, that fan is walking back to their car, they're already thinking about their grocery list. They're already thinking about, you know, what they have to do at work for the day. So to think that, you know, you take up so much space in these strangers' heads, it's like you don't, first of all. And it might sound like a negative thing, but it's not. It should be a very freeing thing, which is that if you think that, you know, you're so important that these strangers are going to be thinking about your mistake forever and ever, like, it's not realistic. And number two is that the closest people to you aren't going to judge you because those are the people that support you without a doubt, no matter what. So it's kind of the situation where the closest people to you will always support you. The people on kind of the outside will forget about it either way. So why are we scared of failing in front of people when it's all part of the process? And you can't have success without failing first. That's all part of the process.
What would you say is a healthy amount of ego to have? And can ego be destructive in everyone's life?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's interesting because it plays on the positive self-talk in a way, right?
This is the yin and yang of it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is. It is tricky. And at the end of the day, I think it's very important that what you say is authentic and it's genuine and you truly believe and it's backed by your efforts, right? So if you say, I'm going to be the best in the world, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But let's look at your training. What are you doing? You know, how are you eating? How are you training? How are you recovering? What's your process like, right? Is this the routine of somebody that's going to be the best in the world? Great. If you say, oh, I'm going to be the best in the world, and then you check in, and over the weekend they're partying and drinking, and they're like not disciplined, and only when they're in camp are they, you know, really about it. It's like, okay, well, that kind of shows us a different story. So it's not just the words that we're saying. It's what are you doing to back it up, and what do your systems look like? What do your habits look like? So at the end of the day, you need to have a healthy ego to go out there and have the confidence to be great. Again, it's very tough to do. It's tough to start a sport. It's tough to become a professional at a sport. It's extremely tough to become a champion. So you need to have this confidence and this belief in yourself of like, I'm going to do this and nobody's going to be able to take this away from me. We need that. It just needs to be backed by proof in what we're doing behind the scenes action-wise, or else you run the risk of posturing as something you're not, walking into the ring, seeing your opponent standing there, and right away you're thinking, oh my God, like,
what have I done?
You know, this guy looks strong or this girl looks quick. Like, I don't know. And you look back to your training and you're like, oh man, maybe I shouldn't have taken those Friday nights off, right? So that's the only problem with posturing as this big thing, when you know behind the scenes that you didn't necessarily do the right things to get you there. That's when all of that big kind of ego turns into doubt in a split second. So if you want to maintain that kind of congruency between how you feel and what you do, make sure that the actions follow suit behind it.
So in other words, too much ego can diminish success. It really can. You don't have to be 100% to put in 100%. That is me as well. I love that. I suppose that goes down to the show must always go on, right? The performance has always got to go on. We always said that when you walk through those change room doors at the show, you just leave all your negative and bullshit feelings on the outside and you continue to go through. Why is that such an important statement?
It's a really important statement, because how likely is it that you show up on the day of a competition and everything's perfect, right? It rarely happens.
There's always something that's going to go wrong, yeah.
Yeah. This concept of 100%, you know, I learned about this a long time. I was younger. My coach recommended a book to me, and they talked about this, which is like, you know, 100% is by definition maximum, right? It's but when we think about 100%, we always think back to like the best we've ever done it, right? You know, what is my absolute peak, the best I've ever looked? Like, that's my 100%, and everything else that's not that is less than, right? But the reality is, it's 100% by definition is max capacity. So you can always give your best. The thing is that 100%, instead of being this stagnant number, it's an ever-changing kind of constant flow state where, you know, when you're sick, your 100% might drop. When you're injured, your 100% might drop. When you're healthy, it might go up. So your ability to give 100% is always there, because it just means your maximum, right? If you have a water bottle, you know, if you have a 500 milliliter bottle of water, 100% of that is that much. If you have a 1 liter bottle, well, then 100% is that much. It's always 100%.
Right.
So when it comes to things like training and competing, a lot of times, you know, people will walk in and you'll say, hey, how you doing? Oh, not 100%. My knee's bothering me. My hip's acting up. It's like, okay, well, you know, you might not be perfect. So just give the most of what you can. You know, if you're concussed and you can't train at all, and all you can do is watch and take notes and watch people train, that is 100% that you can do. It's take some notes, watch people train, you know, pick up on some things if you can. Like, you gave your 100%. So same thing in the ring. You know, it's very rare after a tough camp that you're able to walk into a fight, no bumps, bruises, no sore, no injuries, right? So, you know, it's important to understand that you don't need to be perfect to give the most of what you've got. And if you make that your habit, if you make it a habit to just say, you know, I'm going to wake up and no matter where I'm at, I'm going to give the most of that, you'll get so much farther, so much faster, because you're not comparing yourself to this unrealistic expectation of this perfect way.
Another segue right here. Another segue. That was great, because this was really going to go straight into my next comment. And I want to talk about my man, my brother, fanboy, call me whatever you want, Conor McGregor, when he broke his leg against that vicious fight with Dustin Poirier. Horrible injury, possibly a career ender. The next morning in the hospital, he's doing a message of positivity. Obviously couldn't train, but then he started to develop his physique. So his physique just blew out of nowhere. So instead of sitting there, and mind you, I was supposed to have an injury like that after knowing what happened to Chris Weidman, after knowing what happened to Anderson Silva, to have the power of the mind the next day to be able to look like everything was fine is extraordinary to me. And that's why I'm so fascinated with Connor, is because of the power of his mind. How does he do that? How does he do it?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's not in the nutshell, right? He's done it because this is how he's been for a very long time. I think, you know, what Connor did is he paved the way as a pioneer in a type of thinking. The problem with that is there's a lot of people that try to mimic. You know, I'm sure we're seeing this new wave of people trying to mimic that, and they're falling short, and it's coming across the wrong way because that's not authentically who they are, right? For Connor, the thing about him is that is authentically, genuinely his personality, and that's what makes him great. He says he's going to do something, and he does it, right? The repetition of being able to speak things into existence, give your all, maintain a positive outlook, always stay flexible. This isn't just something that he, you know, it just happened to him once he became a champion. He became a champion because he had this DNA already, right? So when he gets injured and he's sitting there in the bed the next day and he's finding a something to smile about, something to be optimistic about, it didn't just happen. It was the result of thousands of days and hundreds of thousands of hours of priming his mind to see things from a certain perspective, so that when shit hits the fan and you have a big fork in the road, I can either go left or right, you know, left being the wrong way, right being the proper way. It's less of a forced choice, and it's more of a natural, oh yeah, this is how I do things. I'm going to be a little bit more optimistic. I'm going to think, you know, into the future, how I can make this, you know, better. What are some good things I can do in the moment? How can I focus on, you know, giving my all, even if it's a microscopic version of what that looked like a week ago? So I think when it comes to how does Connor have that mindset, it's because he's always had that mindset. And anything you do repeatedly over and over again, it's going to strengthen. And the same way you develop your cardio and your explosiveness and your flexibility, you have to develop all those mental skills as well. And he's been doing that for so many years throughout his entire career, and probably before that, that for him to switch into that mode of thinking is a lot simpler compared to, you know, people just starting out.
Do you think he knew what he was doing all those years ago when he was driving around Dublin and pretending he was in the Ferrari when he was in his little Datsun? Did you? Which is true. He said that. He said, I would think that I'm already the champ driving my Ferrari when I was in a crappy little Datsun. He said he would get excited and he would actually feel like it was. Did you think he knew what he was doing then? Or is it to get you out of to think differently, to pull you out of a shitty situation that you're already in?
It's a good question. Yeah, I honestly don't know what the motive was behind it. I think at a certain point you think, I want something that I've never had. I'm in a situation that I'm not sure can promise anything, because nothing, no level of success is promised. What can I do that's going to make me feel a little bit better? Is it driving and visualizing, you know, that I'm somewhere that I'm not? Is it looking in the mirror and telling myself that I'm a champion and, you know, getting a big poster of the belt and putting it on my wall and standing in front of it? Everyone has a different way to kind of motivate themselves. And it's not necessarily always something you think about in advance, is what's the way that I'm going to think that's then going to set up my success? Sometimes it's just, this feels right, I'm going to do more of that. And it's the reason why it's so important to figure out what's right for you instead of copying what's right for other people. Because if Connor had looked at, let's say, one of his idols and said, well, how did this person become so successful and what did they think to themselves? Maybe it wouldn't have worked for him. He had to kind of do it in his own way. And again, any level of success, you got to be a little crazy, you know, like you can't be a normally sane person to reach these heights that, you know, people like him have done. So, you know, call it a little bit of crazy, which you need. It's a great
thing. He's admitted to as well. Yeah. He said, you got to be a little bit mad.
You have to. But again, it's not just doing it one time, right? He didn't just do it to say he did it. It was a consistent thing. This was just how he behaved, how he acted. And again, you do something enough times, you pave the way for it. Like the analogy I like is, you know, when you're on a trail hiking, how do you know where to go, right? You go because there's a flat part of the ground. Exactly, right? You're not going to go through the tall grass. You're going to go through the part that's been walked 1,000 times. But why do you walk through that way? Because it's been walked 1,000 times. And it's the way that our brain works. Our neurons always follow the path of least resistance, right? So if you're a critical person and a negative person, it's probably because that's how you've been thinking a lot, like for years and years and years, right? If you're anxious about things, you've probably been anxious about a lot of things, and that's just your quickest way to think of things, right? So to create a new mindset almost requires you, like in the movies, to take this big, you know, sword and chop down that tall grass and create a new path. And it's going to be slower. It's going to be messier. But you walk that once, maybe nothing's going to happen. You walk it 1,000 times, 2,000 times, eventually that new path that you just carved out becomes that path of least resistance, and that's the more natural way to go. So people like that, it's not just about doing things once, it's about doing it over and over again because you trust it, and that eventually becomes just the model in which you've created your thoughts to come out.
Fuck. You know what? You would be an amazing addiction counselor. Because that's what they taught me there, is that for you to either go left or right, you've got to change your mindset and just keep going right. And when you keep going right over and over and over again, it just becomes a natural process, not drinking. Yeah, it's going to be tough at the beginning, that first 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. It's hard not to drink a beer. It's hard not to have a shot. But then once you keep doing it and realizing the benefits that you're getting out of not drinking, right? Not drinking alcohol is going to put other things into your life that you never had before. It's so true, guys. The pathways to greatness starts with you. It starts with removing things from your life that maybe will make you regress. Alcohol, drugs, negative thinking, not drinking enough water, not being around positive people, not journaling, not prioritizing. It just all tiles into everything that I need to hear, and I hope that you need to hear it too, guys, because this is riveting stuff right here. Here's another one. If you focus on the problem, if you obsess on the problem and talk about it and complain about it, that's all you're going to see. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. It's funny. A lot of these things are going back to the self-talk, right? Again, and this is for most people that say, well, I don't have, you know, a lot of negative self-talk. I don't think I'm that critical. Like, these are all circling back to it, right?
Yeah.
You know, what you talk about becomes more. So, for example, you know, if you're tired and you work a lot and you work a 9-to-5 and you're balancing training with that, if all you talk about is how burnt out you are and all you talk about is how annoying it is to have to go to work and it's not fair and this and that, what do you think is going to happen? You know what I mean? You're just going through those patterns so many times where that kind of critique becomes that kind of basis in which we think, and it's hard to kind of pull yourself out of that. Versus if you ground yourself in something a little bit better, being a little bit more gracious and saying, you know what, I'm really grateful for this 9-to-5 job because it provides the stability to be able to train. You know, there's a lot of people that don't have that and have to, you know, figure out in some months they can train, some months they can't because they don't have the money for it. Or some people have to, a lot of people do like private sessions, one-on-ones, which again is great because you're at the gym, but you're also reliant on other people's time. And what if people cancel and this and that? You're spending a lot of time at the gym. So something as simple as I work a 9-to-5 and I have to train full time, it's not fair, can very quickly be reframed into, you know what, I'm really grateful because I have a job where I'm not just relying on kind of eating what I kill and doing any kind of service-based thing. I get to work for a company. I get to clock out when I clock out, not have to worry about it. And it allows me to go out there and, you know, train when I need to. So simply just focusing on the optimistic side of the coin, it leads you to better results because it gets you thinking that way, as opposed to always being critical, always having a reason to be upset by something. And it's not that things aren't bad. It's not that people don't have reasons to be upset. But again, if you focus on that and that's exclusively what you focus on, you're only going to come up with more problems and no solutions that way.
So, you know, nothing's forever. Nothing's permanent. If you recognize that, even going through a hard struggle or a hard time, if you know and you say to yourself, okay, this isn't going to be forever, let me take that right pathway by changing things in my life, because, you know, ultimately everything that you do, every single thing that happens to you is your responsibility and it's your life. Okay, here's another one for you. So what's the difference between all these things we're talking about and us creating that for ourselves and God giving us what we want through prayer? What's the difference between those two? Isn't it kind of all the same thing?
I think it comes from drawing on something outside of yourself when there's no guarantee, right? And that's why people use different factors to motivate them. If you're spiritual, if you're religious, if you're none of those things, but you just believe in this willpower to make it happen, I think the similarity is you need to be able to draw on something outside of yourself. You know, the ability to say, everything happens for a reason, so that no matter how bad and brutal and gruesome an experience you go through is, you can use, again, whatever that model is that helps you, whether it's spirituality, religion, anything, and saying, but you know what? I'm going to stay on my path because things happen for a reason. I might not know what the reason is for this just yet, but at some point I will, whether it's tomorrow or it's a year from now or it's 10 years from now, I'm going to look back on this moment and say, oh my God, that's why. So that's why that had to happen. And I think, you know, there's people who say, well, how do you know? You know, people say, oh, everything happens for a reason. Maybe you're just kind of wishing things away. How do you know? And I say, well, we've already had proof of that. I mean, look into the past. Forget about the future for a second. Think about any bad thing that's ever happened to you. There's a high likelihood that you can trace that back to something better that's come from it, or something good that you have now that stems from that happening as kind of the basis to it. And it's like, well, if you can look into the past and you can identify positives that came from even your worst experiences, what makes this current one any different? What makes this worst experience the one that's, you know, changes the model? So if you need a reason to be a little bit more optimistic and look into the future and say, you know what, well, things happen for a reason, but you're not sure if you can trust it, look into the past. Things that are bad, everyone's had bad things happen. A lot of the time we can trace that line to something better. So whatever it is we're sitting through now, whether it's an injury, whether it's a personal thing, anything that can come up, you have to be able to look forward and say, I trust that this isn't just happening without a reason. There's going to be something that this leads to where I look back and I say, oh my God, so that's why that had to happen.
Well, that recently just happened to me. I was booked for to do an exhibition bout for a boxing organization, which was going to be on pay-per-view. Third week in camp, I popped my Achilles. Now, this was going to be a decent payday for me. I hadn't been podcasting for a year and a half. I'd kind of lost the passion. I was doing it from home, and I just didn't want to do it. Literally a week after I popped my Achilles, I met the gentleman that owns this building and said, why don't you just come down and shoot your podcast down here from now on? Now, that never would have happened because I would have continued training to go for that fight and just still not forgot about my podcasting career. That happened, couldn't do the fight. This kind of fell into my lap. So I resonate with that big time.
Yeah, and that's great. And it's great because you had such, it was so soon in which, you know, both of those things happened. And, you know, that's lucky. You know, it's great. Sometimes it happens that quickly. Sometimes it takes a long time. Yeah. But it's that same point of you can always look back and realize that even those, you know, shittiest things that have happened to us have ultimately led to something better. So whatever you're sitting in right now, you have to be able to trust. And that's when you draw on, again, if you're religious, draw on the religion. If you're spiritual, draw on that. If you're none of those things, it's just being able to maybe be more scientific about it and look into the past and use that proof and evidence, right? So whatever it is that you draw on to motivate you, it's that same kind of conclusion we're coming down to, which is things happen for a reason. Trust the process. Keep showing up and doing your best every single day to 100% of your capacity, not perfectly, but to the best that you can do. And it's very hard to mess things up when you're goal-oriented, you're driven, you're intentional with your time, you're doing your best, and you have a plan. Like, it's a pretty good recipe for success.
And I just want to add one more thing to that recipe to success is being clean and sober. That is one thing that I found has really changed everything about my life, is removing alcohol from it. And I didn't realize I was on a path to destruction. I didn't even know that my alcohol abuse was hindering my success with my, I can't watch a lot of my old podcasts from back when I was promoting Connor's Whiskey, and I was in another beautiful studio and I was getting amazing guests, Chris Cyborg, Brandon Moreno. I was doing really well, but I was drunk every show, and I can't even watch them now. Like, I literally cannot watch any of those podcasts because, for one, I can see how wasted I am in my eyes. Like, I see how slurry and I just hate everything about it. So personally for me, and I know it will work for you, is removing substances. Yeah, for sure. Your credentials are pretty high. Can you just give us a little bit of, well, actually, before I do that, let me ask us a personal question. How do you keep your mind positive all the time in the current state of what's happening with your people and the current state of the world? How do you remain positive all the time? Because I think you're one of those guys that if you're ever in a bad mood, people are saying, like, fuck, Dylan's pissed off. I've never seen him like that before. And I bet you hear that a lot. Do you harness it, or do you like let it out sometimes? And if you do, how do you control and stay positive?
That's a good point. I try my best. And again, it's a habit that you can't just kind of expect to just kind of show itself. I work towards it, but trying not to take things personally. You know, I think it's very easy to have something come up either directly or indirectly, take it very personally. You know, that builds and it comes out in bad ways. I try very hard to again, not do that and try to listen a little bit more and say, well, where could this be coming from? Even things that might hit me in a way that I don't love or make me feel triggered or irritated or, you know, aggravated, all those things. I try to kind of take a step back and say, you know what? This isn't about me. This is about something else. Where could this person be coming from? You know, what is their life experience that has gotten them to this point, right? Because we all, you know, no matter what background or where we come from or how we grew up, we're all kind of emotional people, right? So if something someone else says triggers you, you know, it's likely that they're triggered in the first place to begin with, right? So it's understanding sometimes the root of that. And I might not agree with something that my friends are posting or something that I see online, but it's important to take a step back and say, where is this feeling coming from? And if I can't resonate with the delivery, maybe I can at least resonate with the feeling that they felt when they posted it or when they said it or what led to this opinion. And again, it's not just a one size fits all, you know, wave this magic wand and never take anything personally and never be irritated. But I find for me it helps, which is just like that initial sting, taking a step back from it, not just sitting in it and wanting to retaliate and defend it and whatever. But it's like, okay, everyone's coming from a place where they're rational enough, at least from their own experiences. Nobody, I think, purposely goes into something irrationally. So it's, where could this logic have started? Can I resonate with the feeling that they felt to get them to this opinion? And then kind of use that as a place to even the ground a little bit.
Are you learning? Are you learning stuff here today, Lana?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
She's writing everything down.
Basically.
Yeah. So what's resonated with you in this conversation so far?
Honestly, the fact that a little bit of the alcohol, because my brother's an alcoholic, and I think that resonated in a sense of don't let that get the best of you, in a sense.
Mm.
And then also staying positive through like
negative times.
Yeah, because it's a lot of the times where you kind of, people take a lot of the negative things that people say. And like you said, like if you don't have the people around you that are going to support you, because one thing about it is I have a really strong support system around me, which has helped me like chase my career. So not having that support kind of sucks. But yeah. That resonated with me. So I'm like, thank God my mom's so cool. Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
no,
good.
A lot of the things you're saying is fucking on point, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hence the reason why he's one of the world's best mental performance coaches.
Okay, buddy. Shit.
Who's been your favorite? Let's go with the UFC that you've sat down and had like a conversation like this with. Who would be, I mean, I'm sure you love everybody, but is there anyone that stands out?
In terms of clients that I've worked with, I'll say one, and it's funny, it's not UFC or Bellator, but it's why I'm here this week. It's one of the clients I have, Ross Levine. So he's, if you know Karate Combat, it's one of the kind of fastest growing, I think, combat sports out there. You've definitely seen clips of it somewhere, at least. He's fighting on Friday night, this Friday, and he's already the middleweight champion, and he's fighting up at heavyweight to become their first ever champ, which will be cool. And Ross is somebody that, for me, stands out because I think a lot of people can resonate with his story, which is that he doesn't come into a situation like mental training with something inherently wrong, right? Sometimes people say, well, you know, what's the point of mental training if I'm not depressed, if I'm not anxious, if I'm not really struggling with anything? And you don't need to come into it from a place like that. A lot of the time, it's just taking the skills you have and wanting to make it better, right? Like, you can be in incredible shape. You still go to the gym to work out. You don't just say, well, I'm in good shape, I've done it. Right? I'm going to stop eating right. I'm going to stop going to the gym. You need to maintain those things. You need to practice it. You don't say, well, I'm already a champion striker. I'm only going to grapple. No, I'm never going to strike. I'm never going to hit pads. I'm never going to do bag work. It's like, no, if you're good at something, do more of it. Find ways to challenge yourself. Like, be creative. So, you know, Ross is one of those people who is very mentally tough, very mentally strong, but we've done so much work together because he never let that hinder him of, well, I'm already a tough person. Like, maybe I don't need this. You know, we find ways to be creative and to try new things and to make them think about how to approach training with a different objective and a different goal and how to approach a fight slightly differently and all these different ways we can play around with it. And I think it's a really good case study for a lot of people listening because I think the audience will be split. I think a lot of people will say, yeah, I really struggle with some of these things that have been mentioned. Great. And I think a lot of people will say, sounds cool, but I don't know if I'm like an anxious person or if I'm a depressed person. I'm just like a hard worker like most people. It's like, great. If you're a hard worker and you're putting all of this effort into the physical side of your training, I mean, you introduced the podcast with, you said it's, you know, 90% mental, 10% physical. There's a huge emphasis on the physical side of training, but not enough on the mental side. There's a huge discrepancy between the impact of the mental game on our performance compared to the emphasis we place on developing those mental skills. And that's the whole point. If you can be the mentally toughest person out there, but then let's build on it. Like, let's take that great foundation that you have and see how high we can stack that, right? So that's someone that stands out to me that does that in a really great way and will become the double champ because of it.
I know someone that I really like, and I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and I see him liking on all your stuff on Instagram, is Jose Shorty.
Yep.
You know the guy? You guys talk to him, and what are your thoughts on him? Because I think he's a fucking legend.
Yeah, he's great, you know, Shorty Torres. I was introduced to him through Dean Thomas a few years ago. He brought me down to American Top Team to meet with some of the crew. And, you know, Jose, he's one of those guys who just has a good attitude about things. You know, he works very, very hard. He's extremely disciplined. I think this is a good example, you know, with Shorty, of someone that has had his fair share of adversity, of challenges, of obstacles, of fighting in different organizations. But he stays optimistic, he stays goal-oriented and focused on the task at hand, and he's having incredible success because of it. I mean, you know, a career in combat sport isn't just what we think it is, which is you fight regionally, then you fight pro, then you hope to make it to the UFC or Bellator, and then you become a champion. It's not linear like that. Sometimes it's, you know, two steps forward, one step back, three steps forward, four steps back, one step back. It's this kind of choppy thing, and the most successful fighters aren't just the ones that can do it in a short burst, but they have the longevity to be able to maintain that work ethic despite the setbacks. And I think, you know, with Shorty, he's one of those people that has not only shown how skillful he is, but the longevity behind those skills. And I think it's a great, you know, kind of role model to have when it comes to looking at fighters that are successful that haven't just had every single thing go the perfect way.
Right. It reminds me of my buddy who I just interviewed again once the other day. I'm not sure if you've heard of bantamweight Vince Morales. He was in the UFC and then lost three and then got removed. And kind of, I felt when he was coming here, I was like, oh, I feel so bad that, you know, he got removed from the UFC. And one of my questions was, how do you feel now that you're not in the UFC anymore? He said, in the beginning, it was a little bit hard to get used to, but he learned so much more from being removed from the UFC.
Yep.
And he has gotten better since he was removed from the UFC.
You know what? It's an unfortunate situation, but it happens so frequently. I've spoken to countless fighters who went from the regional scene to UFC, and you know, it's not like the NBA or the NFL where, like, once you make it, you make it. You know, you make it to the UFC, and for a lot of people, that's been their dream. You know, it's what they've said in front of the mirror a thousand times: I'm going to be in the UFC, I'm going to be in the UFC. And then you get there, but instead of this weight coming off your shoulders, it almost like triples on top, because you're like, now got a three-fight contract. I've got to win. I've got to win in an exciting way, or else I'm going to be cut. So the thing that you spent your whole career driving towards becomes this weight on your shoulders, and it's so many people who have such a great career leading up to it, and then they underperform in the UFC because they stop doing the things that they did to get themselves there. They start making weird changes. They do things a little bit differently.
That's exactly what Vince said. Exactly that.
And then what happens is they you know, step down from the UFC. They start doing things the comfortable way again, the way that got them to that success. And then, whoa, it's magic. You're back to being successful. That's the problem, is that we feel like we're going to make it to this level. I'm going to have, you know, UFC in my Instagram bio. I'm going to have the jacket with my name on the back, and things are going to be great. But that feeling only lasts, you know, a week. And then right away, you're like, oh my God, like I have a UFC fight coming up. I have to do this perfectly. I have to do this the right way. I have to win. And you start thinking in ways that are less healthy. You start putting pressure on yourself that wasn't there before. And it's why so many people underperform when they first get there, just to be cut and have great careers afterwards, because they let that exciting moment put a weight on their shoulders. Where if you're coming into the UFC and you're starting out, my advice would be keep doing the things that got you there. Don't mess with your training partners. Don't mess with your team, your nutrition. Like, if what you did is working, stick with it. And I think, you know, the example I used a lot of time is with McGregor. You know, McGregor came from a small gym. You know, he is one of the only, like, memorable athletes on a global scale that came from that gym. He didn't make it to the UFC and say, okay, well, now that I'm in the UFC, now I need to move down to Miami. Now I need to move to Los Angeles and train with a big team. Mm. He kept his team. He kept his corner. He kept his training partners. That's, like, what you need to do, unless you have an issue. Again, people have sometimes, you know, they outgrow their team, which is a whole different story, and that's okay sometimes. But for a lot of people, don't leave what's working. You know, it's like if you've cooked the same meal a bunch of times and then you get, you know, nominated for like a Food Network cook-off, why would you change the recipe? Mm. You know, keep the same recipe that got you there. So I think that's a big thing with fighters that are up and coming and kind of clawing away at the UFC or getting those first contracts, UFC, Bellator, PFL. It's like you feel that initial pressure. Don't do anything differently. Continue to do the same things that got you to this level, and it will likely kind of elevate you to the next. Why do we need to change our internal state because, you know, there's more lights and cameras and interviews going on?
And that's what he said, that with all the cameras and the pressure of being in the UFC, he was under pressure not to underperform. Yep. So he was doing things that he wouldn't normally do because the lights and the camera and the action was on him. So, yeah, literally exactly what you just said there. That's a lot of things are happening that I've spoke about that you're talking about in the last few weeks or things that I've been implementing, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because how much would John Orlando love Dylan, Lana?
Totally. Wouldn't, because you're very positive. He would totally love you.
Yeah, he would. He really, I think you would love him on the podcast as well. Can I ask a question? How old are you, Dylan? 32?
I just turned 25.
What? He speaks like he's like 55.
I think that he's...
It's the wisdom.
And the maturity at 25. Yeah. Listen, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I was an absolute dickhead when I was 25.
He still is.
Hey, you're so articulate. When did all this start for you, and when did you become so fucking good at it?
Thanks, man. It came on the sports side. So, you know, my parents put me in Taekwondo when I was 5, and I did it at a very recreational school. I think like most karate, Taekwondo schools, they're not geared for performance. They're not geared for like Olympic style competing. It, you know, get your belts, do your stuff. And that's where I found myself, you know, without even knowing. And I really loved the sparring side. I really, really loved it. And we never got to spar. We never did. And eventually I switched gyms to a school called Authentic Taekwondo in Toronto. And that was a performance-based school. And I learned very quickly, like, I am not good at all. Like, I sucked. Like, I had my black belt, but I was, like, technically terrible. And I had to relearn everything. And, you know, that process was tough, but I had to learn a lot of these, you know, skills as well of just, like, sticking with it, being grateful for the challenges around me instead of being upset by it. And all these things started to slowly build. And then as I got older and I started to compete more internationally and represent Canada globally, you know, I understood for myself too that, like, it's not just who's taller or faster or stronger. Like, to be a great fighter, you need to have something else. Because at the end of the day, you know, when you get to like the quarterfinals of a US Open or you get to the semis of an Olympic Games, like, everyone's going to be great. You know, you look at like a title fight in the UFC, both guys are going to be incredibly strong and fast and like technical. When all those physical skills are pretty evenly matched, the variable that makes the biggest difference is the mental side. And I learned that early on from my own fighting career, and that's why I really started to lean into that. So not only did I want to be the at my best physically that I could be, but I wanted to be the best mentally, and that's what allowed me to not just catch up to where I should have been, but ultimately surpass, because I started off at a huge disadvantage when all my teammates around me and all my opponents had started off at these competitive schools from a young age. I was like years behind. So I realized if I just do the same thing everybody else is doing, I'm going to keep, like, you know, progressing but never surpassing. So I'm like, I got to do something else. I have to figure out what else I can do. And it goes back to what we were talking about of the quality quantity thing is I want to train more and I know I need to do more, but that doesn't always have to look like putting on my gear, putting on my stuff and like sweating and sparring. How can I train in a way that doesn't exert me but allows me to progress? And then it came to all those mental things, the self-talk, the visualizing, the creating goals, the game planning and watching film of opponents like hundreds and hundreds of times until I found like nervous tics that they had that I could exploit when I was fighting them. All these different things came from not just what I was doing on the mats, but what I was doing off of the mat. So it kind of came from a place of having no choice. It's like, I want something that everybody else, you know, wants in my division. I had a severe disadvantage by starting off at kind of the wrong school. What am I going to do to overcome that? I can't just train 100 times a day every day. It's not possible. What can I do when I know my opponents are resting? I'm going to watch more film. I'm going to visualize more. I'm going to focus on the self-talk side of things. And that's kind of, from a competitive side, how I built up some of those skills. And then now I leverage into what I do working with athletes.
I can't believe you're fucking 25, man.
Bro, right? I was thinking the same thing.
Seriously, it's an extraordinary abundance of maturity for someone your age, especially of this generation.
I have a quick question, though.
Go for it, Lana.
Where exactly did you get this wisdom at just 25? Was it trauma? Or was it like, do you have mentors? Do you have your parents? Like, what is it? Because how do you think like this at 25?
it's a good question. I mean, I don't want to say the corny thing about it just being DNA. I think a lot of it is just kind of DNA. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, how I was raised, I think.
Yeah.
Especially in my high school years. I mean, you know, first of all, growing up, like, I had very supportive parents who cared that I was doing well and not just like performing well. Like, you know, my parents would much rather that I was like in a good mood and happy than like what my grades were. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, I get that.
My mom, for example, like if I failed a test, for example, my mom wouldn't get mad at me. But if the teacher had called and said that I like bullied someone, then she'd get pissed, right? So they
situational.
My parents really instilled, like, again, they were strict when they needed to be, but like in the right ways, I think, where they valued like who I was as a person instead of just kind of the accolades that I had. And then that carried out into when I was like in high school competing. Like, when I was in high school, I would train 3 times a day. So I would train from 7 to 8 in the morning. Our coach would drive us all to our different schools. After school, we'd come back and train from 3 to 5, grab a quick bite, do some homework, and then we'd train with the rest of the normal class from like 7 to 9. So like, and then we were traveling all the time because Taekwondo is a very international sport, especially on the national team. Yeah. So, you know, my entire high school career, I was Europe, Asia, South America, like you name it, just traveling all over the world. I remember my second semester of grade 12, so like my last semester, I think there were like 80 days in the semester. I had 46 absences from just competing. And,
wow.
You know, I spent more time with my coach than I did with my parents, honestly. I mean, I'd wake up and my mom would drive me to training. And then at the end, you know, she'd pick me up and I'd come home and maybe eat quickly or most of the time not, because I was cutting weight. And like, I would see them very, very rarely. I never saw my brother. And I spent all my time with my teammates and my coach. And I think that helps a lot. I mean, you know, my coach was not old school, but definitely more traditional and like the values that he had for us. So, for example, you know, if we went for like a team dinner, you know, pouring everyone else's water before you're like little things like that as, you know, a 15, 16 year old kid, you know, it sticks with you. And I think when you mix just kind of the DNA I might have and how I was raised with my parents and, you know, the great teammates I had and the coach that stuck with us throughout the entire process. You know, it was hard to go wrong with that environment, and then as well just kind of sticking with it. So probably a bunch of different factors. But I think, going back to the McGregor thing, like sometimes you just have to start with a bit of a spark, and then if you nurture it the right way, it goes in the right direction. But, I mean, we all know a lot of people that have that great talent that don't, and it kind of goes underdeveloped. So it's a little bit of a mix of having the right stuff and then being able to kind of like foster it the way that it should be.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Do you
he's not real. I think he's an alien.
You know, I was gonna say, if the generation if there was more of you 25 year olds that took a page or a leaf or however you want to say out of this young man, we'd have a much better society. 100%. How can people book you? How can people find you, and how can people get you as a coach?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, most of the stuff is on Instagram. If you go at MindLock with an underscore on Instagram, there's a ton of posts there. I mean, everything from giving tips and tricks to showcasing the athletes that we work with, like we were talking about, everything from UFC, Bellator, PFL, Olympians, like all of the main combat sports organizations are people that I've worked with, and there's a ton of great kind of case studies from them and good videos there. So Instagram's a great place. You can always email me, you know, info@mindlock.ca. I mean, but that's the cool thing about Instagram, I find, is all the links are there and everything too. So I would say start there. You go on YouTube. There's some podcasts. I mean, I've done a ton of podcasts as a guest. I've tried to host some too and give a bit of a different perspective from that standpoint as well. But yeah, go on Instagram at MindLock with an underscore, and that'll give you kind of everything you need to know.
Now, can people personally book you for private sessions, whether it be on Zoom or in person?
Yeah, so almost all of the sessions that I do are online just because of the athletes that we work with are so abroad. Like, I mean, we have, I personally work with athletes in Canada, US, Australia, Thailand, Europe, like everywhere, which is great because of, you know, the internet and how that stuff works. So, you know, you don't need to be local at all, especially because I'm based in Toronto. But I think it's helpful that way. I think, you know, especially as a busy athlete, you don't always have time to drive to an office and take time out of your day and sit in traffic. So some of the athletes I work with, you know, will do a session in between their own training sessions, or maybe they're driving home, or maybe they're, you know, they got back after a long night of practice and they're eating and we're doing a session. So it can be as structured or not as, as people like, as long as there's like a baseline to it. But yeah, it's all pretty much done online through through FaceTime or Zoom or Skype or whatever people like. And that's what makes it accessible and global. And I think just easier for everybody to manage.
I want to say, like, as a testimony, I always judge when I'm doing a show on the way that it makes me feel. Internally, if I get emotional, if I get goosebumps, it's happened to me multiple times during this. If you're listening to this and watching it now, because Spotify, you can watch. If you're watching this and listening to this, you know that I can guarantee that a lot of you are resonating. So if you want to change your life, if you don't know where you're going wrong, if you want to go right instead of going left, then I suggest that you get a hold of this man right here, this young man right here, because I believe that people like him can give you the skill set to develop the mind. Oh, am I here now, Emma? Where? Can you put the freaking light on?
It was on.
Am I psychic or what?
No, it was on you, but because you spoke about him, I just pointed right here so I could show him. You ruined it.
Oh, okay, I ruined it. But we don't edit in this podcast. We keep it exactly how it is. I don't think I've ever really... Being 53 years old and had a bit of a tortured life, I don't think I've ever looked up to someone that's more than half my age.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever looked up to someone to where I feel that this man, for lack of better words, is superior to me and my knowledge of things that I'm trying to develop on my own. So I really do appreciate that. Was this basically like a session today?
No, not really. I mean, you know,
but it was for me.
for you. I mean, listen, like it's, I mean, a lot of these concepts, yeah, like these are concepts that will come up a lot of the time. I mean, giving 100%, you know, managing injuries, that always comes up, you know, with the self-talk. I mean, all of these concepts for the most part, yeah, like these are the structures in which we'll base conversations around. A lot of the time, you know, there's a more formal kind of exercise or activity that comes with it, which is let's take that, put that in some sort of exercise that you can then take on your phone, screenshot it, you know, pull it up before practice and remind yourself to do. So a little bit more of a structured approach to it. But these are all the building blocks. Like everything that we touched on today, a lot of those are just building blocks to different mental skills. You know, like my job as a mental performance coach is to develop the psychological and behavioral side of competing at a high level. And these are the tools that help you do that. So, you know, even if someone was listening and they took one thing away that they were like, you know what, that sounds like it could make sense, I'm going to try it out. That, like, that's amazing. And it's something to get started with. And it's not going to work the way you wanted to at first, but like anything, you do it over and over again, it gets a little bit better, and then you'll be happy that you started.
I'm going to definitely start journaling after every podcast. I suppose the laziness in me thought, hey, I can just go back and watch it. But there's a difference in actually writing it down, would you say?
Yeah, you know, the ability to watch it is great. I think that's probably a luxury that you have that athletes don't when it comes to training. You know, you're not really going to watch over your training sessions. But there's also things that, you know, if you wait a week and then watch it back, you might forget how something made you feel, or if you got distracted at a certain point, or if you got emotional at a certain point, or if you felt compelled to say something. Like, that will fade the longer you wait, and you'll be basing it off of just kind of what you see. You know, how did I speak? What did I say? What was my body language? Like, those things you can pick up from video. More of the, like, interpersonal things and the emotional things and the internal things will fade a little bit as the days go on. So being able to just write that down right away, and if you feel like you're pressed for time and you don't want to put an entire list of, like, an hour-long podcast, then maybe leave more of the broader things out of it because you can circle back. I would say do both. You know, write down instantly some core things that really stand out, some of the more internal things that won't pick up on video. And then when you go back and you watch the video, then you can look at, you know, what you said and how you said it and the body language and the posture and all those little things that video will do more than enough for.
Yeah, I'm very fidgety when I do my podcast. I'm always moving around. I don't know if that's something to do, whatever it is, but when I watch myself, I'm constantly moving. I'm either adjusting my glasses or the mic, or I'm flicking around. So that's definitely one thing that I'm definitely going to work on. Can you look at someone or talk to someone and establish what their mindset is?
What do you mean?
So what would you say my mindset is by being here with me today for 1 hour? What have you picked up from me from that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think at least at the surface level, you know, for someone like you, it's clear like how much you care about what you do. You know what I mean? Like, this is something that you're passionate about, but as you've already expressed to this point, it hasn't always come easy. You know, you've had setbacks, you've had obstacles presented in front of you, but look where we are, right? And like you even explained, in your younger years with substances and all that, I think you being as optimistic as you are, I think, is more commendable because you've had the opposite be true as well. I think if you're just raised by the perfect family and the perfect team and the perfect coaches, and, you know, you live a very, you know, kind of simple life and padded life, you know, you could be positive, but you can't, you will never know if it's like authentic until you're like really punched in the face. You know what I mean? For you, it sounds like you've been punched a lot. And the fact that you're here and you're trying hard and you're engaged and you're focused and you're staying optimistic and present, like, it means more because you've seen the other side of it, which means it's been even more like, you've been more proactive about making that happen. You haven't just kind of settled in. I think that's one thing about you that stood out, is there's nothing about you that isn't proactive, from the plushies on the set to where the mics are to the cameras to the work that you do behind the scenes to understand the guest even more. Like, there's a proactiveness to that, which obviously stems from caring. And I think as long as you never let that go, even when you have three guests booked per day and you start to cut corners, it's like, you know what, instead of going halfway through their page, I'll look at their last three posts, right? As long as you maintain like that, being proactive, being curious, I think is a big thing for you that stood out. Like, that's what's going to get you to where you need to be. It's not the microphones, it's not the lights, it's not the plushies that like are going to make people watch these videos. It's the quality of the questions you're asking, the genuine curiosity that you have, and the passion that comes through the questions that you're asking. And as long as you have that, which, by the way, can never be taken from you, people can come in and they can close this studio tomorrow. You know what I mean? They can move these mics and get rid of the cameras and all that. But the one thing that no one can ever take away from you is that passion, that curiosity, that spirit, the same way that we have that fighting spirit. As long as you have that, you never need to worry, because no one can take that part away from you. And that's why you'll be successful for the rest of the time, brother.
I love that. I love that. Speaking of the plushies, which one's your favorite out of the ones that we have? Well, I think I know which one's going to be your favorite, but if there was one of these plushies that you would like, which one would it be?
Why do you say you could guess which one?
Because I see you stare. You've been staring at it the whole podcast.
Maybe I've been throwing you off. You know what?
He said, fuck you, I'm not predictable.
I'm wrong. Liddell.
I like the Chuck Liddell.
And this is what we call a sponsorship segue. Guys, today's episode was brought to you by Get Big Shots plushies. I keep talking about this, and I'm going to talk about it one more time. Christmas is coming up, okay? If your husband, boyfriend, son, mother, father are huge UFC fans...
It's childish.
Lana, can you imagine your husband coming down the steps Christmas morning and you've got 10 plushies sitting on the couch waiting for? I can tell you now, you're going to get coffee and breakfast in bed for the rest of your life, guys. And it's quality stuff as well, okay? These aren't no joke. They've got all of your favorite characters from the UFC, the WWE. They've got everyone you can think of. GetBigShots.com, okay? Now, check this out. If you use my promo code MDSLV, you're going to get... Let's do 10% off everything that you buy. Great quality. They're affiliated with the UFC, and we just love having them. That one's for you, brother.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. The OG.
The OG, right? Yeah. I think the first UFC fight I ever saw live was Chuck Liddell, Randy Couture 2.
Wow.
And that was back in, I believe, might have been 2006.
I had the reason this one stood out to me too is I had, what were they called, round five or round nine or something? I had one of those.
Many people have said that.
I have a GSP one. Yeah. I have a Chuck Liddell one. Yeah. I have a Nate Diaz one. And yeah. I had those when I was like a little kid. Yeah. So this one stuck out to me. I'm like, I have a Chuck Liddell in my office right now.
There you go.
I like this one.
And you can take a little nap on it as well. I had one of the fans do that. Have you seen that?
That's awesome.
Isn't that great?
That's awesome.
Guys, if you're losing your hair, or if you want to lose some weight, or you're having some erectile dysfunction problems, rizpharma.com. Cut out the hassle of going to the doctor. Cut out the hassle of insurance. All you got to do is go online, register up, talk to the doctors online. They'll diagnose you. They'll send you your medication discreetly and directly to your door. Erectile dysfunction. Keep your wife happy. Rizpharma.com. Wow. Use my code MDS, 15% off. Had to do those plugs because without those guys, we can't keep going. Dylan, what's your message, bro? What's your message to the world?
That's a big one. That's a big one, man. You know what? I would circle it all back with saying, just do your best. You know, I think this is an interesting time for a lot of people. You know, some people are really thriving. Some people are really struggling. Do your best. You know, if doing your best means eating a quality meal and that's it, then do that. If doing your best means, you know, going back and watching some old fight footage and you know, breaking down some gape tape, do that. If doing your best means crushing all three of your training sessions and your strength and conditioning and your stretching, do that. But I think more people, or everybody, even me and you, I think we need to be more accustomed to just making that the target. Instead of having a perfect day, do the best with what you've got, and you'll always be one step closer to where you want to be instead of setting this target, something, you know, in a place that's not as achievable, failing to hit that and then feeling like a failure because of it. Just do your best, and whatever that means, redefine that every day if you need to, but it's something that we can always do.
I love that.
This is one of the – this podcast is one of my favorites. This is in my top three now. I had Stitch Duran – he was one of my favorites. I had David Norton, who was the lead actor from An American Werewolf in London, my favorite horror movie. And now I've got you.
Wow.
This is one of the favorite ones I've ever done. I feel amazing, and I'm going to go home and talk my wife's head off and tell her everything. I'm gonna be standing up. She even predicted, she goes, when I told her who I was talking to, she goes, oh, okay, I know you're going to come home and you're going to be like, which is what I do. Thanks for coming on today, bro.
Thanks for having me.
I can't wait to do it again with you when you're here in Vegas.
Yes,
and
sir.
If there's anything that we can do to collaborate in the future, I know we kind of don't know each other, but we've connected online. I'm going to be more proactive to stay in touch with you because I just
please, yeah.
I really, really do love it, and I love what you're doing, and I'm so impressed by you. I am blown out of the fucking water. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, brother.
This is the Marcus Deegan Show. We're walking out of here with a big fucking smile on my face today. And it's not because this is my second Coke. It's just because I've been filled with positivity and love and direction. This is Marcus Deegan shooting from Las Vegas. Make sure you like, share, and subscribe. I love you guys for watching and supporting me. I seriously do. I really, really do. And if there's anything I can do for any of you guys out there, send me a DM. You want to come in and co-host an episode with me? DM me. I'll bring you down 100%. You got any questions that you want to ask the athletes? DM me. I'll ask them for you. I'm here for you as well, as much as you've been here supporting me. Love you, truly do. This is Marcus Deegan. We're out. That was great.